Good morning. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Tomorrow afternoon, the annual Dean's Distinguished Lecture in the Natural Sciences at UW-Milwaukee's College of Letters and Science welcomes an award-winning scientist, writer, and educator from the other side of the state.
Sean Carroll is the Alan Wilson Professor of Molecular Biology and Genetics at UW-Madison, and he's the author of a new book, The Serengeti Rules. The book uses true stories of scientific discovery to explain how scientists connected the dots and came to understand how all of life is interconnected. Ahead of his appearance in Milwaukee, we reached him via Skype. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, always a pleasure to talk with you. And this time it's about a new book called The Serengeti Rules. And I suppose we should start right there. What are the Serengeti Rules and why should we care about them?
The Serengeti Rules is a label I applied to some basic discoveries about how the world works on the larger scale, on the ecological scale. The rules that determine the numbers and kinds of, say, animals and plants that live in any given place. And we should care because understanding those rules has to do with how we manage the places that supply us with what we need. You know, we're animals and we need animals and plants for food and for maintaining the places that we live. And if we don't do that well, bad things happen.
Right. And a lot of people saying bad things are happening because we have ignored those rules. Do we understand those rules implicitly or do we have to have them spelled out to us?
Oh, no, I think we have to have them spelled out because there are a lot of surprises. So and we should, you know, rather than bashing ourselves too much, you know, we didn't understand a lot about how nature worked, say, 50 years ago. I mean, it was pretty obvious you didn't want to just destroy it and pollute the heck out of it. But we really didn't understand the interactions that take place in various habitats. And we wouldn't understand, for example, how carnivores, right, meat eaters, influence the abundance of plants. Mm-hmm. Huh? Yes, that's exactly the response one might have. But 5 decades or so ago, pioneering work by folks like Bob Payne, a late ecologist at the University of Washington, Seattle, started to understand those connections, that some animals have disproportionately large effects on other creatures in various habitats. And when those animals are perturbed, there can be really big ripple effects.
I think it's understanding that the sort of synergistic, you use the word regulation a lot in the book, and how all of this has rules and regulations that need to be, I mean, there's some slack, but that really need to be followed in order for things to sort of hum along the way they're supposed to.
Sure. I mean, you know, Wisconsin's a place with lots of freshwater lakes, right? And we've all become used to, for example, the scene of a lake that's absolutely choked green with algae. And we're like, no, you know, I'm not going to swim in it. I'm not going to fish in it. I'm not going to let my dog, you know, run through it, et cetera. But that's not at all normal. That's a lake that's sick. That's a pond that's sick. What's happened is that the algae have overwhelmed the controls, the regulations that are in place that otherwise balance what's going on in a pond. And now that pond is no longer productive. It's not doing the sort of things that it can be doing for humans and for other creatures in the area. But these are reversible things. In fact, it was University of Wisconsin researchers maybe 3 decades ago starting to experiment on some lakes up north, learned how to flip these lakes, to switch them from turbid green to clearer and more productive and containing more fish kinds of lakes. So we don't have to put up with this, and it's not, you know, we don't necessarily have to radically change our lifestyles or anything like that. We can do a better job at maintaining the places that sustain us, both, you know, whether that's because we like to eat fish or swim in the water or whatever it might be. But we could have a lot nicer fresh water all across North America if we gave it a shot.
Yeah, you mentioned Lake Erie as one of the examples, and having grown up on it and knowing not to even touch it, let alone eat anything from it or drink from it directly.
Yeah, I grew up on the edge of it in Toledo, Ohio, and I never ate anything that came out of Lake Erie, never swam in Lake Erie. You know, it was in really bad shape, you know, pretty much notorious in our culture. But that's not the way, you know, things should be. That's not the way things need to be. Lake Mendota, to my surprise, I didn't even know about this until actually fairly recently, but the year I arrived at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, one of the largest ecological experiments ever undertaken was going on in Lake Mendota to flip its state from something that was getting pretty grungy, you know, early in the summer and where a lot of fish populations had crashed, to try to restore the clarity of the lake, try to restore the balance of fish populations. And it was an experiment that was largely successful, done right under the, you know, public eye in terms of the city of Madison and fish enthusiasts and, of course, the state government. So, again, you got to know the rules, and those rules have been worked out by ecologists that understand the effect that one species has on another and another in sort of a chain reaction type way. And if you don't know those rules, if you don't know those interactions, you really don't understand the game, and you're blind to the effects that you might be having.
Do we ever get to a point, though, where we have messed it up too far and we can't correct for it? I mean, I think about the Amazon, for example. Are we going to get to the point where we cut too much of it down and we can't save it?
You might. Funny you bring it up. I was in the Amazon last month, and for the first time ever, and with my own eyes, finally saw the vastness of part of it. And it is breathtakingly enormous. The amount of water, it is just hard to, I just can't describe it. I needed even an aerial tour by seaplane to just get some sense of all these rivers. And because a lot of the area floods seasonally, that does limit human development. And Brazil and other countries have caught on that the Amazon sort of makes its own weather. That's how big and complex it is. And trees play a big part in that. And so the destruction of the Amazon has abated to a certain degree as governments have realized that it's in their own worst interest to, you know, sort of continue the path that we're on. So it is possible to destroy things. But in the book, I talk about some places that were essentially left for dead, that were decimated, for example, of wildlife. A place in particular that I've been, I know well, is in Gorongosa National Park in Mozambique in southeastern Africa. It was a jewel of Mozambique, a place where the jet setters, the Hollywood types, went in the 1960s because of great concentration of wildlife in the center of the park, elephants and buffalo and hippos and lions. After 20 years of civil war, essentially all that was gone, from thousands of elephants to 50, from thousands of hippos to fewer than 100, from 14,000 buffalo to fewer than 100, you know, just decimated. And people thought that it was, you know, a lost cause. But starting in 2004, an American philanthropist named Greg Carr teamed up with the government of Mozambique, and they've been trying to bring Gorongosa back. And the wildlife populations in that time span have gone from about 1,000 large mammals of all types. If you add up the antelope, the elephants, the buffalo, et cetera, there were about 1,000 in 2004. There are 71,000 in 2015. So it's roaring back. And so we know this in other cases. There have been species hunted to almost extinction, like elephant seals in the Pacific, down to about 20. They're back to 200,000. Other species that have experienced protection, you can see sometimes, you know, just an explosive rebound. So I guess it ain't over till they're extinct. And extinct means zero, and that's it. But there are lots of cases of being brought back from the brink of extinction. And, you know, I don't say that to just, you know, gloss over the challenges, but, you know, we do have to have some hope based in experience. And those experiences are out there.
Well, what about the human animal? One of the chapters, you're talking about how populations regenerate. And I'm thinking, you know, we've eradicated so much of what used to kill us. And well, and because of that, our population has exponentially exploded and doesn't seem to be slowing down terribly much globally. Do we get to the point where there's just too many of us and that can't come back?
I think that's a serious issue. You know, at 7 billion plus, there's a term in ecology, the carrying capacity. So, you know, how much can the planet produce, you know, for us and the other things that we depend upon? You know, we're a pretty big animal by animal standards, you know, at 150, 180 pounds, you know, or larger. And, you know, we consume a lot and we now live a long time. And so if you visited 200 years ago from, you know, another planet, and then you visited today, you'd go, wow, those large two-legged beasts have really spread all over the place. But we're animals. We need food. We need water, right? We need shelter. You know, we need rainfall to grow that food. And, you know, we can see in various parts of the world the ability of the land and water to support us is being strained. And that's, I mean, don't even, before we even mention climate change, that's the situation just from routine human activity without the added complexity of climate change. And so we just have to be mindful that we are taxing the Earth's ability to supply us with what we need. And I think there's, you know, essentially regional crises in the ability of those parts of the globe to support their populations.
It seems like we have somehow managed to outwit the regulators and the regulations, and the rest of nature hasn't caught up with us.
Well, that's true. I mean, the regulation for us has generally been disease, mm-hmm. and the story of medicine for the last century has been, you know, especially to eliminate and reduce childhood diseases so that people make it through childhood, they live a longer life. Life expectancy has, you know, almost doubled, you know, since the turn of the last century. That's very dramatic, as and our population has grown somewhat around fourfold. Agriculture is so much more efficient. So we're an incredible, I mean, you can look at it, there's two sides of the coin. We're an incredibly clever species and being able and having figured out ways to, you know, improve our chances of survival, you know, shelter and public sanitation and vaccination and antibiotics and all sorts of things. But we haven't quite fully turned that cleverness to designing sustainable systems that will, you know, feed us and provide water and all that sort of thing without degrading those resources. So, you know, the book, I talk about stories of various places in the world that are, you know, beautiful and interesting and all that, but it's really about, it's not so much about making the world pretty as making it functional and making it able to support us. And, you know, certainly, you know, not causing, you know, greater harm than necessary in doing so. And that just means, you know, just being a little smarter, a little better informed about how we behave. Maybe even not a little, but I think, you know, recognize that nature has rules and regulations, and so humans need them too.
Are you hopeful that we will learn these rules and regulations in time?
It's a great question. I think scientists are by nature optimistic, and a lot of the people I know, including somebody I talk about in the book, Greg Carr, you know, doesn't see there's really no alternative to optimism, because that's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. So, you know, I think a lot of life is about trying, right? No matter what walk of life you're in, you know, we're always striving, you know, whether we're trying to, you know, master an instrument or, you know, learn to paint or be a better gardener or whatever it might be. And, you know, collectively we're striving to be a wiser society and to, you know, hand off the world in no worse shape, I would say, than we inherited it. But, you know, that takes some self-sacrifice, that takes some planning, that takes some, you know, collective action. But we've done a lot of things together in the past. One of the stories I talk about in the book is the eradication, the only human disease that's been eradicated from the planet, which is smallpox. And this was a terrifying, massively deadly disease for most of civilized human history. No one thought you could eradicate that from the planet, but an 11-year effort from 1966 to 1977 involved hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people across the globe working in the most, you know, remote villages everywhere. Eradicated it. Gone from the planet. It was during the Cold War, and Russia and the United States cooperated, and a lot of countries that weren't even members of, you know, the World Health Organization cooperated and things like that. So even in times when, you know, the world has been in a fair amount of turmoil, we've pulled together to accomplish some things. And I think that, you know, more and more people are aware that what we're doing is not often sustainable. You know, we're draining the groundwater out of California. You know, that's going to catch up to us. You're not going to be able to grow all those crops in the Central Valley. We're fouling lakes and rivers that we'd like to be not only just to enjoy, but also to be productive and to have water that we can, you know, rely upon for irrigation and things like that. So, you know, it's hard with all the present pressures to plan for the future, but, you know, it's something that we're smart enough to do.
Well, and I think it's also a sort of an awareness, maybe as a species, that we are part of the cycle and the chain, too.
Yeah, the dubbing in the Serengeti rules was no accident. This book begins on the Serengeti, and to get to the Serengeti, I drive right past Olduvai Gorge, the site of so many important discoveries about the history of our species. You know, the Serengeti, that kind of environment is exactly where, you know, we came into being as a species and our ancestors came into being over the last several million years. So, you know, we were governed by rules out amongst these big animals. And really, we haven't fully escaped those rules. You know, we need food, we need water, we're susceptible to disease, just like every other living creature. And, you know, we have to be more mindful of our effect, you know, the massive effect we have because there's now so many of us in the world.
Well, Sean Carroll, it has been such a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Sean Carroll is the Alan Wilson Professor of Molecular Biology and Genetics at UW-Madison. He's also Vice President for Science Education at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute in Maryland and author of The Serengeti Rules, The Quest to Discover How Life Works and Why It Matters.
He'll give the annual Dean's Distinguished Lecture in the Natural Sciences at UW-Milwaukee's School of Letters and Science tomorrow afternoon at the Zelazo Center on the UWM campus.